Hey everyone, welcome to the Front Stretch Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. Now, it's a Saturday night as we're recording this. We don't have Mike Neff with us at Homestead of Miami Speedway, but I do have my colleague, Mike Massey, and I have the owner of FrontStretch.com, Tom Bowles, with me. We got a lot to talk about, a lot's happened this weekend, but let's do a cup preview, because big championship race on Sunday. Guys, from practice, there's only been one practice, because on Friday, both practices got rained out. They switched qualifying on Saturday to a practice session, a 50-minute practice session. That's all that the cars have been on track this weekend, and they're pretty equal, as we thought they probably would be. So let's kind of dig into this. Denny Hamlin, he was quickest among the three drivers in practice on one-lap and 10-lap averages. I know, you know, if you listen to the podcast, I've kind of touted his horn the past, 3 months or so as my championship favorite. But Massey, I'll start with you. What do you think about Hamlin so far this weekend? Obviously, only 50 minutes on track.
Oh, well, I think it is his race to lose. I mean, he's fastest in practice. He gets the number one qualifying spot, which gives him the best pit box. And as he said, it was karma for last year when he gave up that pit box to his teammate Kyle Busch to help him out with the championship. And like you said, I've thought all year it's Denny's year to do it. Just ever since he won the Daytona 500, how magical that night was. It just seemed like a different Denny Hamlin than the guy that, you know, choked in those championships in the years past. I think he finally gets it done.
Yeah, and Tom, it's kind of funny because Denny was, you know, I talked to him on Thursday at the media day in South Beach, and he said that his homestead was last week at Phoenix. They've already won homestead, so this is kind of they're going for fun this weekend. Now, we've seen a Denny Hamlin in the past that's kind of broken down at times when the moment's gotten to him, but I truly feel like this is his day at homestead.
We're going to find out how much that win at ISM Raceway changed his mindset, because that's been the knock on Denny for a while, right? Over the past decade or so, since 2010, is that he's not able to get the job done in big moments. But I think he proved, most importantly to himself last week, that when he has the right equipment and he has the right situation, he can get it done. And now I feel like he has, in some ways, nothing to lose this weekend at Homestead. And I think he comes in with the right attitude. The question is going to be, for me, when he does hit adversity in the race, lap 100, lap 150, something happens. Maybe they lose a couple spots on pit road. Maybe it's a loose wheel. Maybe it's just an ill-handling set of tires. How does he respond to that? And I think that's when we'll really know if Denny's over it. I think he's taken a lot of steps in the right direction. And I think we've seen he has a high level of confidence this weekend. He's bringing Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
I mean, can you not, you know, bring a bigger celebrity in? So he's got a lot of people on his side, but he needs to be able to close the deal.
Yeah, and he said it's a normal weekend. I asked him and Truex both in the press conference today, and he said it's a normal weekend. Now, do I believe that?
Yeah, it's a normal weekend hanging out with MJ.
Yeah, I don't think so. But hey, if anything was normal last week, you know, he can transfer that momentum into this week. And like you guys said, his confidence is at an all-time high heading into the championship weekend, the championship race on Sunday. But he's got two teammates in this race, and they're pretty sporty as well. We'll start with Martin Truex Jr. Obviously, you know, he's got 7 wins this year, quiet 7 wins, guys. Tom, what's your take on him? Because, you know, we had dinner tonight, and you think he's the guy to beat.
Yeah, he's actually my pick to win, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But I think Truex has flown under the radar this year, and we don't talk about what he's done enough. Here's a guy whose team shut down last season, and it was based 2,000 miles away in Colorado, so he has to take his crew chief, Cole Pern, and bring him to North Carolina, bring him to a brand new organization in Joe Gibbs Racing. Sure, they are running Toyotas, and Toyota is the top manufacturer right now. Sure, that is the top team, top to bottom across the board, but you still have to fit in, you still have to be the right, you know, have the right chemistry. Just because you get put on the New York Yankees doesn't mean you're automatically going to make the starting lineup. And I think they've done a really good job of fitting in there and picking their spots. You know, Truex has grown in certain ways this year, winning at all these short tracks and taking a step in the right direction there, where he was winless on short tracks throughout his career. And I think he's taken a step forward at racetracks he's needed to take a step forward on. Well, them together, him and Pern, having the quiet confidence that they can go into Homestead, execute, and then come out with another title. And guys, if he wins, that's a first, a second, and a first in a 3-year period. That's as close to a dominant stretch as you're going to get in this modern era, especially with this format.
And obviously last year, he could have won that race too.
Right, almost had 3 straight.
Yeah, had he won the war, as we call it, with Joey Logano. But Massey, I mean, what's your take on Truex? Because, you know, as Tom said, he's been dominant this year, and it's really, it's been quiet. He was in spurts at the beginning of the year, wasn't that great. Middle of the year, really good. Then kind of faded off going to the playoffs. So it's one race. He won this race in 2017 to win the championship. Harvick won it in 2014. Kyle Busch won it in 2015. Can Truex win?
Well, he can, absolutely. If Denny Hamlin, Denny Hamlin's my pick, obviously, but if something happens to Hamlin, I think Truex is the guy to jump in and win it. I think he's the second favorite for this weekend. And this year feels a lot like 2017 with him.
It does.
He very quietly dominated and won the most races of anybody. And he's actually has the same amount of wins that he had entering Homestead that year. So it could be an identical season.
Sure. And like you said, it feels like the same as 2017. Well, this is a good transition to Kyle Busch because he says this whole playoffs feels like 2015. And if we remember what happened at 2015 and he told us today, he stomped their ass at Homestead. So, Tom, Kyle hasn't been great in the second half of the year. He's on a 21 race losing streak, which is terrible for his standards. But can he do it? Can he get it done? Because we've seen him get it done before.
Well, a lot of people have said that Kyle emotionally has not been in the right place the last couple of months. But what I've observed at Homestead this weekend is a guy that's creating an island for himself within JGR. I noticed even in practice, in final practice, he wasn't running next to the 19 and the 11. And he came in for his presser apart from Denny and Martin. Mm-hmm. I think he has this type of mentality where everybody around him is doubting that he can be the champion. And he's trying to use that to his advantage a little bit. And let's face it, I thought that Kyle, he was second in the 10-lap averages, but he was on top of the charts in final practice. I thought the 18 may have had the best car on speed that we've seen so far this weekend. It's whether he can execute that over a 267-lap stretch. And that's been the problem, right? Is that he's had some of the old Kyle mistakes from years ago that have come back and haunted him mentally during this 21 race losing streak. And it hasn't been to the extent of past years, but it's been just enough that people are starting to doubt him, especially when you've got two teammates alongside him that are doing so well.
Yeah, Mike, you and I watched the beginning of practice today outside in turn 3 and 4. And, it, you know, the 11 and the 19 went out at the same time. They looked pretty equal. As Tom said, the 18 looked pretty good, though. So what's your take on Kyle?
Well, I'm never going to bet against Kyle Busch winning a race. Any track. I mean, he's the only guy. Well, until the Roval, he had won at every racetrack.
Yeah, right.
But I still kind of count that as winning his every racetrack.
Charlotte.
Yeah, because it's at Charlotte. But, yeah, I don't know. He seemed like he was in a better mood this week. For Kyle Busch standards. For Kyle Busch standards. He's still a little cranky. But he didn't seem as kind of, I don't want to say out of it, but just not there, not as dominant and as focused as he had been like the beginning of the season when he was winning the four races. So I think maybe he got, you know, got things straight and he's just focused and settled in to perform this weekend, and he can absolutely do it.
Sure. You got anything else to add?
Somewhere in the middle, I was about to say, in between where he was emotionally a few weeks ago and where he was at the beginning of the season. And a Kyle Busch somewhere in the middle is still plenty good enough to win the championship if all cards fall his way. Let's not forget he won the Owners' Championship Friday night in the Truck Series, which was a mild surprise, with Christian Eckes and his number 51 truck, and that's got to be a little bit of a boost, even though he was trying to say it doesn't really translate.
It would be ironic if, you know, Kyle Busch kind of bashed his aero package the whole year, and then he hoists the trophy at Homestead. So something to think about. But guys, there's a fourth guy in this championship four. He drives the number four car, and it's Kevin Harvick. And out of the four cars, I feel like he was a tick off today, but not too much. You know, it's reasonable. He could get back in it. He's the closer. Though if you ask Mike Neff, he is not the closer. But Harvick, we've seen him win, you know, win it all in 2014. And I feel like he could do this because he's getting hot at the right time.
Well, the advantage he has is that, you know, Joe Gibbs Racing, they're split amongst three right. cars, trying to get three cars to go for the championship.
You got 400 employees going for one car.
Yeah, 400 for one car. So he's got all hands on deck going for that four car to help him win. And that's a huge advantage. I mean, they all noted it at Media Day on Thursday that, you know, he has that advantage. He's not just this lone wolf, that this underdog. It's Kevin Harvick. He can win anywhere as well. So, you know, it wouldn't be a surprise at all. He's not my pick, but I could definitely see him winning it.
But when you're down seven cylinders the whole season, it doesn't matter how many employees you have working on your car if you're that much behind. And I'm not saying that Kevin Harvick's really far behind. He's had an incredible year making the most out of equipment that really has been third best all year. It hasn't even been the best in the Ford camp. I would argue Team Penske, top to bottom, is better than Stewart Haas Racing right now. And we saw in practice, he was seventh on the 10-lap averages. That's still really good. And I know he has a good track record at Homestead. We saw Justin Allgaier in the Xfinity Series today, which we'll get to in a little bit. He was just that little bit behind those guys, and they were running circles around him. Yeah. He was never in contention for a single lap, really. Maybe half a lap out of those 200 laps, you know, somebody that you thought could steal the title. So if the three Gibbs cars come out firing like they did in Saturday's practice, it really makes it hard for me to see Harvick somehow breaking through that, unless he and Ronnie Childers come up with some crazy pit strategy that gets him the track position he needs and some cautions fall his way.
Yeah, it would be crazy, though, if you got 75% of the championship for Joe Gibbs Racing and then that other 25% wins. But we'll have to see on Sunday. Last year, we obviously saw the championship four finish 1 through 4. I think, by far, this is the most stout championship four we've had. You got the four best in wins, top fives, top tens. It's your average finish. Are they finishing 1 through 4 on Sunday?
Probably. Let's say it's very likely. But you could see some other guys like Kyle Larson, Joey Logano, Keselowski, get up in there and mix it up. And those guys have no stake in the battle, except, I don't know, maybe the Ford teammates with Keselowski and Logano. Maybe they need to help out Harvick. But Larson has no stake in the battle, being a Chevy guy. So, you know, it could spice up the running order a little bit.
I think Larson's an interesting case because the last couple of years he's led so many laps here, but I think he's been real tentative at the end to try and make a move against the championship guys. I think he's really been deferential to them, and I see that continuing. Team Penske, like you said with Logano, I don't think is going to be that deferential. I think that Logano himself is pretty motivated to come out and make a statement. I think he was really close, obviously, to making that championship four and is deep down a little bit upset that he didn't make it. So I think he's got an opportunity. And if you look at Keselowski, here's a guy that I don't really think gives a rat's you know what. Like, you know, when he's out in contention, he's out fighting for the lead. And that's what we saw in practice today, is that Joe Gibbs Racing and Team Penske were clearly the cream of the crop, as they have been for most of the last, you know, most of the 2019 season. And I think anybody from Team Penske, even a Ryan Blaney, could come in and spoil that 1-2-3-4 party a little bit.
For sure. Well, we'll have to see on Sunday at 3:17, I believe, is the green flag. But guys, before we, you know, transfer to the Xfinity race, because that was a hell of a race today, I do want to talk about two guys that are retiring after Sunday, at least full-time competition. Let's kick off with Paul Menard. He's been around the sport for a while, drives for the Wood Brothers the past 2 years, hasn't had a ton of success, won the Brickyard, though, if you're going to win one race in your career. Brickyard's not a bad one to win. Probably not going to be a factor for the win, although he does have Penske equipment. But, Tom, what memories from Menard that stick out to you, and what do you think his impact and legacy has left on the sport?
Paul who? I think there are going to be some race fans that are going to say that, because he's not really an outspoken guy, one of the few guys left that doesn't really have any social media. But like you said, he won the 2011 Brickyard 400. That was a really impressive victory. And there are a lot of people that have been going their entire careers to try and win Indy. And when you look at Menard and his longevity, what I'll remember about him is he never really tore up his equipment. And people knocked him as a driver because of the family connection, because the Menards have so much money. It was really easy to keep him in a seat in this era of pay to play. But he was a guy that could bring your car home in 15th on an intermediate track in one piece, not really cause you any problems, and be consistent in that way. And even though he only made, I believe, one playoff appearance, he had the consistency to a level where he was around 20th in points every year. He earned his spot on the circuit. He wasn't a guy that was running 35th, you know what I mean? So he was your average. I kind of look at him as like almost like a blue-collar average guy that went to work every day, did his job, worked in the same job for 20 years, and it's not like he did anything special. But at the same time, he was there and he did his job, and you appreciated that.
And I personally appreciate his bluntness with the media, even though like he hates doing media appearances or requests. But I appreciate his bluntness.
Yeah, he'll tell you straight up.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, he's getting this this little like cult following that will miss him. And then obviously the biggest highlight of his career was Brickyard 400, you know, winning that race and a couple of Xfinity races as well. And he's with the Wood Brothers. Everybody loves the Wood Brothers. So they're making a big deal about his retirement. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It, the great thing is that he's not leaving. He's retiring, but he's not fully leaving. You know, Menards is still hanging around to sponsor Matt DiBenedetto and Ryan Blaney and several other series and drivers. And so I think that's great that he's still, you know, he's in it for the long haul.
Yeah, the Menards name will still have an impact, whether it's him or John Menard. And he wants to take a bigger role within the company. Another guy, David Reagan. And, you know, I got some personal memories with Reagan that go back from when I, you know, when I was a child. So, I appreciate Reagan. You know, he started off his retirement weekend at the Comcast Community Champion of the Year Award. We'll get into that here in a little bit with an interview with Mike DeToyen. But Massey, Massey, David Reagan, you know, you've talked to him in the past. Really nice guy, like I said, but, you know, only got the two wins on Super Speedways. One with the Front Row, which they're honoring that car from 2013 this weekend. Lasting memories from Reagan.
Yeah, obviously, the win at Talladega was just the coolest moment of his career. Just still that mental image of him and David Gilliland just flying through the field during the tandem years. That was a really cool moment. Big for Front Row Motorsports. And that's the thing about him. His longevity and commitment to Front Row Motorsports has been huge for that company and really just helped to keep them, you know, relevant throughout the years. And I mean, overall, he's just going to go down as one of the good guys.
Yeah, for sure.
And he's had a long career, but he's only 33 years old.
Yeah.
Right? So he's still got plenty of life to live, plenty to do, you know, other than just racing.
Yeah, he was full-time at 21 with Roush. And, you know, really, I mean, Roush, that was kind of on their downward spiral. Only was there a few years, 4 years, 5 years, and then went to Front Row. And then 2015 was all over the place with Front Row of the 500. Then Kyle Busch got hurt, went to Gibbs, and then Michael Waltrip Racing. So what's your lasting impact on David Reagan?
I thought that Reagan was a really nice guy, but when you look back at his career, I think it's a career of unfulfilled potential. And there were several inflection points, let's say, in his career, like with Roush. I remember his second year full-time with Roush. He came so close to making the playoffs. You guys remember that? He was the first guy on the outside looking in. And then from there, he was just never able to get over the hump with Roush. And even though he won, eventually, with UPS as the sponsor, it was too little, too late, and UPS bailed at the end of 2011. And then he ended up in several other opportunities where he could have earned a top-tier ride again in a substitute role. He was with Michael Waltrip Racing for a while. He subbed for Kyle Busch when Kyle Busch was hurt. But he could never really take full advantage of those opportunities and never wheel that car into victory lane when he had that chance. And so he always ended up in this no man's land of being a super sub when there were openings, but just stuck with a Front Row Motorsports team that, even though it's grown over the last several years, is really not a contender outside of the super speedways of Daytona and Talladega. So here he is at 33 at a dead end when I feel like he was a guy that 10 years ago was looked at as one of NASCAR's hot young talents. It's really kind of a shame that his career never panned out because he is a really nice guy.
Yeah, and I don't think you've seen the last of David Reagan at all. I think Paul Menard, I think this will be his last race in Cup. I don't think that's a fact for Reagan. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if he runs in the Daytona 500 for Front Row. But guys, a lot of stuff happened, and you know, we'll fully recap it with Neff next Thursday. But I do want to talk about the Xfinity Series, and something with that, you know, that we're going to talk about next week is Daniel Suarez getting bumped out of the 41 and Cole Custer replacing him. Now, that leads me into the Xfinity Series race today because it was a classic, I thought. It was a classic championship bout. Really, three heavyweights battling each other up. I know you said earlier Justin Allgaier wasn't really involved, and he really wasn't. He didn't run the top five much at all today. But for a lot of the race, it was Cole Custer, Tyler Reddick, and Christopher Bell trading blows at the front. And Massey, it was fun to watch. We were watching it together in the press box and seeing Custer come to the field after, you know, having a loose wheel. He went a lap and a half down, went and got that lap back on the last lap of stage two, and that really saved his race. And then it was right there at the end, and Reddick gave him a dive bomb with, I think it was 17 laps to go, and Reddick got his second championship.
Oh, it was the best championship race I think I've watched. I mean, it was just a couple of gunslingers just going at it. You didn't know who was going to come out on top. slide jobs galore and just rim riding around the top. I don't know how Tyler Reddick didn't hit that wall.
Yeah.
More than, I mean, I think he rubbed it a little bit one time. But, you know, if that was a lesser driver, they would have just torn it to shreds. But, man, that was such a cool battle. And we get to see that as all three go to the Cup Series next year and battle for Rookie of the Year. And so we'll be watching these guys for years to come, I think, to have several more battles like that, hopefully.
For sure. That was a good battle. It will be a good battle going forward. And I know you enjoyed it too, Tom.
Absolutely. And I thought that Reddick did a great job of conserving his equipment. And Richard Childress has had such an impact, and he talked about this in his post-race presser, on him as a driver and getting him to dial it back. And I was listening to his radio channel throughout the race, and RC would come on, especially early in the second half of the race, and say, listen, dial it back a bit. Make sure you save your stuff, in his old Childress drawl and in his way. And Reddick listens to him, and Reddick also listens to Randall Burnett, his crew chief, and does a great job of taking that information and, you know, making sure he doesn't overdo it. Because I thought that Christopher Bell overcooked his stuff a little bit, and he struggled on the long run too, but I think that he didn't manage his stuff as well as he could have. And at the end of the day, it wasn't that Custer didn't manage his stuff well. It was that Reddick managed his stuff just that little bit better and was able to hit that outside groove just that little bit better than Custer at the end.
Yeah, and that's interesting that you said that he listened to RC, because I remember some audio from last year's race when he was racing with Junior Motorsports. And Dave Ellens at the time was his crew chief. And he told him, you know, get off that wall. And he stood on the wall and, you know, rim riding around the track and ultimately found his way in his first championship. But Tom, second straight championship for Reddick. And I feel like obviously the first one, whether he earned it or not, I mean, he went out and did just like what Matt Crafton did last night and won. Crafton didn't win the race, except he won the race. But second championship in 2 years, two different teams. That's the first time that's ever happened, back-to-back championships with two different teams for one driver. You know, obviously he's graduated up to the Cup Series. So, I mean, what's your thoughts on him? Because he's a real talent.
If somebody's going to rejuvenate RCR, it's going to be this guy. Because you look at who they've picked up over the last several years, let's take the whole grandson thing out of it. Austin Dillon won an Xfinity Championship with Richard Childress Racing. You know how many wins he had in 2013? Zero. So Reddick is coming into the Cup Series with a heck of a lot of momentum with his championship. He's got six wins. And you pair him with Dillon, I think that's going to push Austin a little bit, try and make him better. But, you know, some of the other drivers that he's had, say Hemric, moving up and being a Cup rookie this year, Hemric never won in the Xfinity Series. So I think there's a true talent difference, or at least from what we've seen so far with Reddick, that could parlay itself into the Cup Series and give RCR that much-needed momentum boost it needs to be more competitive on that level.
And quickly, I do want to talk about Christopher Bell, because this is his second year making the championship four, second year coming up short to Reddick and Custer. Finished third in the championship standings, fifth in the race. He was pretty bummed after the race, and he was bummed going into the race because it was going to be his last race in the Xfinity Series. And, you know, one thing I will say, being the beat writer at Front Stretch for the Xfinity Series, these three have elevated this series over the past couple years. And I know maybe it's really top-heavy this year, and it's the first time that three series regulars went at least six races in a season with Reddick's win tonight. But these guys are going to be missed, and Bell's one of them. And unfortunately, he's not going to have the opportunity now to win a title in all three series, because it's very unlikely he's going to come back down to Xfinity anytime soon.
Right. He was the best shot at being the first guy to win a title in all three series. It all comes down to the fact that he's not that good at Homestead.
Yeah.
I mean, he said it himself after the race that he's good for a short run, but he just, I don't know, I guess he doesn't manage the tires too well there. But either way, he's still going down as one of the best Xfinity drivers ever. Just his win percentage.
Kyle Busch level.
Yeah. If he keeps doing, you know, spot starts like Kyle Busch, then he'll eventually catch, or, you know, somewhat get in the range of Kyle Busch. He probably won't catch
at least win percentage
yeah,
wise.
Yeah, win percentage wise, not total wins wise. But I will say, there was a lot of talk about dirt racing after, right? And Chase Briscoe saying, you know, as a dirt racer, I'm comfortable running up towards the outside wall. And I think that's why Reddick's very successful too, is because we have that experience, and, you know, we can go to Homestead and feel comfortable, and we are doing it knowing that we've already done it on dirt. And I'm surprised that Bell never really was able to parlay his level of experience and have the same level of success at Homestead, right, guys? Like, he's just, he's feeling very uncomfortable there, and you could tell.
Yeah, I think for sure. I mean, you look at guys like Chase Briscoe, who took to that place in 2017 in the Truck Series, won. Today he won stage one, and he ended up coming back to finish third after knocking down the wall late. So him, Reddick, Custer even has a little bit of a dirt racing background. So, yeah, I would say that's the case too.
Yeah, he missed it by a year, Christopher Bell. If he'd been coming through the Xfinity ranks next year when the finale's at Phoenix, I think he'd have a much better shot at winning the title. It's just for some reason that track doesn't suit him the right way.
Sure. Well, guys, any final thoughts on the Xfinity race?
I think it was the best championship race I have seen under this playoff format, and that includes Cup and Truck.
The Cup race last year was pretty good.
It was.
This race was just classic, you know, the big three battling it out. I agree.
Yeah, and it was the three best drivers in the series showing their hands and putting their best foot forward, and I really felt like there were no outside factors that really decided this race. It was really the three of them just going at it, and it was great to see.
I just want to give a shout-out to Landon Castle.
Oh, my God,
for getting Morgan Shepherd his first top 15 in 10 years.
238 starts.
Yeah. So Landon has done an incredible job. Of course, they had funding this week. That allowed them to race to the end of the race. And hopefully they have more of that going forward. But, man, it just showed that car had some speed and Landon can get up on the wheel.
Sure. Now, keeping on this Xfinity theme, we got an interview with Mike DeToyen coming up. Who's Mike DeToyen, you ask? Well, Mike DeToyen is the president and CEO of Dover International Speedway. He also is an advisory counsel at the USO Delaware. So I talked to him on Friday at Homestead. He won the Comcast Community Champion of the Year award this year with his support of the military. So let's get to my conversation with Mike DeToyen. So, Mike, you won the Comcast Community Champion last night, the year award. $60,000. What's that mean to you in the USO Delaware?
Well, I mean, it was an amazing night last night, especially to be able to celebrate that with David Reagan and Artie Kempner, who are friends, and they're just they're selfless guys, and so they really do set a nice benchmark for everybody. But for us, for USO Delaware, $60,000 is a significant amount of money that we need, and funding is always an issue with not-for-profit organizations. So $60,000, there were a lot of volunteers, staff members, and USO, even corporate in Arlington, was celebrating last night along with me.
Really? And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not government funded.
No, that's the thing. You know, the USO has been in existence since 1941, and it's been really inextricably linked to our military and has really been kind of the force behind the force. And most people think, and I actually thought it was government funded until I got into better understanding about the USO, and it's not. So it is its own standalone entity. So independent funding from individual donors is critical. So what Comcast did for us last night was really incredible.
Yeah, and I believe that there's, you know, there's the USO supports the U.S. service members in over like 200 locations countrywide or worldwide?
Worldwide. So there's actually over 200 USO centers around the world. There's about 600 full-time staff members, about 30,000 volunteers that are really the backbone of the organization. And so we're one thin slice of that in USO Delaware, which has obviously the honor of bringing home our fallen heroes through the dignified transfer. And so that's what makes ours special. But we're all really by the side of our military men and women from the point they get into the military, during their military career, and as they transition out. We're really there to help them and their families, which are equally important along the way.
Yeah, and you brought up the story last night. You said it was either from a family from Phoenix or from California. They had a fallen service member from their family. They were coming because all of them go to Dover. And the USO actually, like the night of, correct, they went out to Walmart because that was the only place open at 3 a.m. To get clothes because in the middle of winter. When was that, last year?
Yeah, that was a couple of Februaries ago, and there are so many stories like that are really kind of heartwarming, and they're gut-wrenching, but at the same time, it's really kind of inspirational to know that we have families that are, you know, no one wants to be a member of no one wants to be a Gold Star family member, but we have men and women that are really have volunteered to protect us. And you know, I don't know, and I won't ever know what it's like to lose somebody like that, but The USO is really there to try to give as much care and compassion as we can to the families that have to come to Dover to receive the remains of their loved ones.
How did you originally start helping out the USO?
When I got to Dover in 2007, and shortly after that, I took a tour of Dover Air Force Base, and I didn't have any other, my father was a Marine and fought in the Korean War, but I didn't have a military background. I took a tour of Dover Air Force Base, and that's when I really learned about our USO, USO Delaware, and what it does. And I had just become a volunteer, and I happened to, one of the first things I did was to be a volunteer at a dignified transfer, which my responsibility and a few of the other volunteers was just to make sure that there was enough food there for the honor guards and everyone that was executing that that transfer. And that's when I really became exposed to, and that's kind of that defining moment that I've talked about, where you never really know when something is going to hit you and hit your heart and stay in your heart forever. And that was a moment in time where I just, you know, it really kind of hit me that we've got men and women that most people don't know that are fighting and losing their lives. And it's not on the it's not a media story. It just happens. And that was the first exposure. And right then I just felt like I'd never be able to serve, but the closest thing I could get to serving would be through the USO.
And kind of off that, in the video that was submitted to Comcast and they played after the banquet last night, I guess I'll call it, you said you wish that all Americans could be with you when there's a service member that comes back, their remains come back. Why do you wish every American could be with you to see that in the honor and the dignity that is shown to the military?
Well, you know, I think one thing that most people hopefully would agree is we're all grateful Americans. And we, I think, sometimes lose sight of the fact that there's still a war going on. You know, back along with World War I, World War II, there used to be wars. We'd win the war, we'd come home, there would be peacetime. But wars, in the last 25 or 30 years, we've been at war. And I think if everybody, it was kind of, I've described it before as like this horrible inspiration at the same time to see this this young man that was brought back in a transfer case, and knowing that that young man had volunteered to stand in the gap between good and evil to protect all of us, if everybody could realize that men and women are willing to die for us. And that's really why I wanted everybody to be there with me, to recognize that these guys are heroes for doing what they're doing. And I think when we always throw around the term hero, in that particular instance, there's nothing that exemplifies a hero than when somebody gives their life for their country. There's nothing more noble a human being could do is to protect our country and, you know, give their lives to us. And so I think if everybody saw that, they would really appreciate that we are, our men and women are in harm's way, and they volunteered to do that for us.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Now, in 2007, you began your tenure at Dover as the president. How quickly did you attach yourself to the USO there in Delaware? Because it's, what, 6 miles down the road?
Yeah, it really is five or 6 miles down the road. I got there in January 2nd, 2007 was my first day, and I think it was the summer of 2007 is when I had become, you know, a board member or a volunteer. So it was about 6 months from the time I started at Dover to becoming integrated with the USO at Dover Air Force Base.
But now you're at the advisory council?
Yeah, so we have our USO Delaware has 3 full-time staff members. We have an advisory council of 12, and then we have about 200 volunteers. So my role now is chairman of the advisory council.
So what's that include?
The chairman of the advisory council, really, you could divide it up into 3 different things, but primarily it's to help to run, just really run the business and raise money for the organization and set strategies and just help watch over P&L and the staff members. Part of that responsibility is to be an active member, not just be a stiff board member, but actually participate shoulder to shoulder with the volunteers. And then the other portion of what I enjoy doing and is necessary is to support our volunteers, because without our 200 volunteers, it would be impossible for us to execute all the programs and missions that we do for the National Guard, the active duty, and the reserves around the state of Delaware.
So on the motorsports side, where did your enjoyment for motorsports come from?
Honestly, it wasn't until I got... So my background has been operating minor league baseball teams, minor league hockey teams, arena football league teams. And I went to my first NASCAR race. It was then I think it was the Busch Series back in St. Louis when I was living in St. Louis back in the early 2000s. And I, you know, I just thought it was organized chaos right at the time because there was just so much going on, but it was a great event, a lot of excitement. And so I had interviewed for the position that I'm in today. I'd interviewed because the Gateway, the track in St. Louis, had a vacancy. And so I went to Dover to interview for that position because our company owned Gateway at the time in St. Louis. And Dennis McGlynn, who was the CEO of our corporation, we got along really well. And what he appreciated most is that I didn't have a motorsports background, so I could bring a different perspective to the sport. And so he hired me. So my first cup race that I've ever attended was the one that at Dover, which I was partially responsible for. So thanks to Dennis was the one, and he's been in the sport for a long time, and he's been a great mentor of mine, and he's the one who's really helped me navigate my career in the NASCAR world. And the more I got into better understanding the sport and all the different stakeholders and how it worked, the more passionate I became about the sport, because it's, I just think it's unique from all of the other stick and ball, I guess is what call them. And it's been outstanding. And there's some phenomenal people in this industry. And we met two of them. Well, we didn't meet them, but, you know, David Reagan and Artie Kempner is an example of the amazing people that are in our sport.
Did you ever think you'd be running a track and then also a big part of the USO in Delaware, or just as part of the military in general?
No. The answer is N-O. My wife and I talk about it all the time because we're from the Midwest. We're from Iowa. And if anyone would have said, someday you'll be running and you're going to be in NASCAR and running a NASCAR track, and that you're going to be deeply involved with our military with a lot of different programs, including some at the Pentagon, I would have lost every dollar I had, because it was just so far from where I thought I was headed, and here I am. And so I think life happens, and you just make the best uses out of the you make the best choices as you can, and you make the best use of it. And I never would have guessed it. And fortunately, we've been really lucky with those decisions.
For sure. Now I'll get you out of here on this one. Comcast obviously does a lot for the military. Between 2015 and 2017, I'm sure you know, they got over 10,000 jobs for military members, and they plan to do 11,000 more by the end of 2021. So what's it mean to kind of represent Comcast in a way by getting this award, and them, kind of the military come in full circle?
Well, it's really humbling, because I know that Comcast is really kind of the global leader. There are a lot of companies or organizations or individuals that kind of talk about trying to integrate themselves and be pro-military, but Comcast is showing it. I mean, they're actually doing it, and they've got the numbers to show for it. And they've got a wonderful team that they've assembled to really kind of make those goals and objectives come true, and they're well on their way. So a global leader like Comcast, and the fact that one of their core values is community service and giving back, and by hiring veterans and integrating them into the civilian world, which is one of the most difficult things that our men and women transitioning out of the military, is to how do they transfer those skills into the civilian world. And fortunately, Comcast is being led by those that have served and that are now successful in the civilian world. And for them to be as ingrained and integrated as they are with trying to help our veterans and really showing it and doing it and leading all of the other major global companies by example is amazing. And so what they've done for our sport and kind of bringing that vision to our sport, I think is inspirational to everybody in the NASCAR industry, because they're kind of setting the tone. And so I think getting an award from Comcast especially as military-centric as they are and committed as they are to our veterans. You know, it's an honor for me to be a part of that, and I think it's terrific what they're doing for our industry as well.
Agreed. Well, congrats on the award last night, Mike, and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, y'all. There you have it. Fun conversation there with Mike Tatoyan. Hopefully you learned a bunch about him and his mission with the USO Delaware, because I know I sure did talking to him. It was fun chatting with Massey and Tom Bowles there to preview the Cup race, as well as reviewing an awesome Xfinity race on Saturday. Regardless, that's a little tease and audio enjoyment for you guys on Sunday morning before the Cup race, as it's been a wild weekend here in Homestead. We'll have that and much more this week on the Front Stretch Podcast with Neff, including an interview with Xfinity Series champion Tyler Reddick. Until then, we out.